And welcome to Buy the Book. My name is Nahum Siegel. This is the Nahum Siegel Network on NahumSiegel.com and JMNAM.org. Tuesdays, we get an opportunity to check out one of the latest literary works that are out there and examine it with the author themselves. And we call this Buy the Book. This is the inaugural edition of this hour, of this radio program, brand new to the Nahum Siegel Network, and I thank you for tuning in. We're brought to you by Koren Publishers. Koren has an incredible array of publications and has been out there for years and years educating our public, and we are going to be meeting some great authors and really examining some very interesting works over the next few weeks. You can check out their website, korenpub.com. That's K-O-R-E-N. pub.com. In front of me is a brand new book entitled Malachim Aleph, Kings Number 1, Torn in Two. The author is Alex Israel. It's part of the Magid Studies in Tanakh series, and again, available on the website and in your Judaica stores. And now we get to say, Alex Israel, welcome to the Nahum Siegel Network.
Thank you very much, Nahum.
A pleasure to speak with you. Why does one embark on a project to write about Malachim Aleph?
That is a great question. Well, I'll tell you, it relates a little bit to the work that I've been doing for years here in Israel. I've been teaching for about 20 years in different yeshivas, modern Orthodox yeshivas, and midrashot, women's seminaries. And one of the things that I love to teach is Tanakh, particularly Nevi'im Rishonim. One of the reasons of that is because it really starts with the entry to the land of Israel, ends with the destruction of the temple, and it gives people a history, a running history of the ups and downs of the Jewish people. The idea of statehood, suddenly students from England, America, South Africa, coming to Israel for a year and they're experiencing living in a Jewish country for the first time. And you open the Tanakh, and it's not just learning Pasuk Rashi. Suddenly, what they're hearing in the news, questions of national defense, are popping out of their Tanakh. Suddenly, questions of corruption, which they see in the newspaper or they're hearing about in government, suddenly they're reading about similar things in Tanakh, and they realize Tanakh has this phenomenal relevancy. And so we're learning about a critical period of Jewish history, a period in the history when there were prophets, when God was really communicating with his people. It's very exciting to have that closeness to God, and suddenly it's connecting in a really big way.
You know, it's interesting because in a way, one could argue that Tanakh, in this case Malachim, is more appropriate for today than maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or other recent times in Jewish history.
I couldn't agree more. I think the return to the land of Israel, Zionism, you know, when you read the early Zionists, you read people like Pinsker, Aharaam, Aleph Dalet Gordon, they kept on saying, you know, Herzl said there's a problem with the Jews. The Jews experiencing anti-Semitism. But many of these people said, no, there's a problem with Judaism. We can't stand the shtetl Judaism, small-minded, worrying about whether we put on our left shoe first or our right shoe first. They looked at the Bible and they said, hold on a second, once upon a time we had an economy, we had an army, we had government, we had an infrastructure, we had a taxation system. That's Judaism. That's not just, you know, history. That's actually Judaism. And now that we've come back to Israel, I mean, obviously, you probably, I'm sure many people realize that the people who really got into this first were the secular Zionists. They went back to the Tanakh and started, you know, naming all their kibbutzim according to names straight out of the Bible.
Right.
And they were the ones who started hiking Bible in hand all around the country. And it's taken a while for us religious Zionists to catch up, but we're catching up. And we're returning to the pages of the Tanakh.
Rabbi Alex Israel is with us. He's author of Malachim Aleph, Torn in Two, Magid release. Koren Publishers brings you this segment of Buy the Book here at the Nahum Siegel Network. Rabbi Alex Israel is a master educator who's teaching over the past two decades has inspired thousands of students in the U.S., Israel, and the U.K. to engage deeply with biblical texts. He currently teaches at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi and is Director of Community Education at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. An active writer, he also contributes regularly to Yeshivat Har Etzion's Israel Kashitsky Virtual Beit Midrash. Rabbi Israel, you mentioned such an important thing about focusing on, I guess, what some people would call minutia. You mentioned about the tying of the shoes. I think we can give a million other examples. I know that a friend of mine calls it bubblegum Judaism, where it seems sometimes people are much more concerned about the kashrus of bubblegum than they are about the future of the Jewish people. Is this a trend that somehow seeped into Jewish history at some specific point or slowly during a specific era that can be pointed at? Or has this been a problem with the Jewish people from the beginning of time?
Nachum, I love that question. That is a great question. The best answer I can give is an answer which was given by Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a wonderful... Rav Kook sees things in a very evolutionary way. And Rav Kook claims that actually part of the problem of First Temple Judaism was we had these prophets, and they were talking about things like social justice. They were talking about the big ideas. They were talking about idolatry and sort of religious orientation. And he says, ultimately, they failed. How do we know that the prophets failed when they spoke about social justice and not keeping idolatry? Because the temple was destroyed and the people went into exile. That was their biggest failure. He said, suddenly in Second Temple Judaism, the character we know as Ezra HaSofer, and the people, the men of the Great Assembly, maybe some people recall the first Mishnah in Avot, Pirkei Avot, where they talk about making a fence for the Torah, establishing many students. Suddenly Judaism started expanding. That's the period in which blessings were written down, in which our prayers were written, the 18 blessings of the Shemona Esrei. Suddenly things like Muktzah was created. Judaism expanded in leaps and bounds during the Second Temple period. Rabbi Kook says something remarkable. He says, you know, Judaism only survived because of that sort of minutiae detail-oriented Judaism. But he warns us that sometimes we can get so caught up in the details that we miss the wood from the trees and we can't see the big picture. And therefore, Rav Kook assures us that when we come close to the redemption, as he puts it, prophecy has to return. We have to return to ability to see the big picture. Big picture, morality in its full scope. We want to have religious leaders who talk with a large moral voice and who are aware of the influence of world cultures and world religions and can talk to that grand stage. So I would say, yes, Second Temple Judaism is where we start getting into the details. It's really, really important. I think it's held Judaism very strongly. You know that statement, more than the Jews have kept Shabbat, Shabbat
right.
has kept Judaism.
Right.
But sometimes we've got to also widen our lens, widen our scope.
Well, if minutia is credited with keeping the Jewish people around, then I would say today we are on the road to survival, constant survival.
Well, I will say Rabbi Kook talks about, he quotes a rabbinic statement that when we get to the end of this process, people will despise the rabbis for this.
Ooh.
They will have a very hard time with Judaism because they feel it's too detail-oriented, and there are many people who do feel that way.
Oh, boy, and if you look carefully at what's going on in terms of Jewish leadership, there is somewhat of a rift that has developed over the last couple of decades.
That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's right. Rabbi Alex Israel is with us live via telephone. Malachim Aleph is our topic. The subtitle is Torn in Two. It's a Magid release. Koren Publishers is responsible for it. You're listening to Buy the Book here on the Nachum Segal Network. Not to be redundant, because you mentioned this in your introduction, but I'd love to expand on it a bit. The Tanakh Revolution, based on your words regarding the founding of the State of Israel, and even those who are not necessarily in a religious Zionist camp took a very strong interest in Tanakh. But in some of the material I was reading, one would conclude, and I think you'd agree with this, that in the last 20 years specifically, not just since the state 65 years ago, but really very recently, there seems to be an explosion in the study of Tanakh. Anything specific, or is that just simply an outgrowth of your original theory?
Well, I think that something happened about maybe 40 years ago, or maybe along with the Six-Day War. Tanakh started entering into the yeshiva system. And really through that it came to the religious system. In the shtetl, people didn't learn Tanakh. They were scared of it. They wanted to study through a rabbinic lens. Maybe they were scared of the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. After the Six-Day War, people reunited with places like Hebron, with Shiloh, with Jerusalem. And suddenly people wanted to start studying the Tanakh, even in yeshivas, and not just through the commentaries. One of the groundbreaking places where that happened is the institution in which I studied, Yeshivat Har Etzion.
Right.
And people like Rav Yoel Ben Nun, people like Rav Breuer, masters of Tanakh, were teaching there. And the amazing thing they did was just to teach raw Tanakh. I have in front of me, sitting on my desk, a Tanakh that I've been using for the last 25 years. It only has the words of the Tanakh in. And when I want to study something, I start with just the text itself, try and feel its contours, try and connect with its rhythm. And then maybe I'll look at Rashi, I'll look at Midrash. But that connection with Tanakh is remarkable. Now, this has caught on like wildfire. All I can say is every summer there are Tanakh study days here in the yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion, and we're overwhelmed with over 3,000 people coming for an entire 5 days, rushing from class to class. I teach in the Pardes Institute. We have a tour with text program where we have a few classes and then we go out on a tour. We're inundated. We started off the first year with 10 people, next year 20 people, you know, one bus, two buses. So people can't get enough of this stuff. People are seeing that this really is relevant.
And two points I'd like to emphasize. The first is that in terms of the days of Tanakh, I forgot the official title you gave it, take place during the summer. I know people actually come from outside of Israel. People plan their trips to Israel around that week.
It's exuberating. It's like a festival. It's really exciting.
It's pretty remarkable. And then you talk about pure Tanakh and Tanakh without any interpretation. At some point, I would guess, a scholar like yourself does turn to those commentators who have things to say about Psukim in Tanakh. So at what point does one incorporate that? Or at what point do you encourage your students to start bringing in some of the commentators and commentaries in regard to Tanakh?
Menachem, again, I'm loving your questions. I grew up in a school where I think we studied Rashi before we learned the text. I remember looking for those midrash. You know, next week we read about Abraham smashing the idols. I thought that was in the Bible.
Right.
I didn't realize that was just a midrash. I looked for it for years. I didn't understand why I couldn't find it. I thought I was looking in the wrong place until I realized it was a midrash. It's the first story everybody learns about Abraham. The idea is to see rabbinic commentary as a commentary on the text, but for that you have to understand the text first. And you want to be able to see the personalities that we're dealing with. You know, the Book of Kings opens up with King David.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is how you view King David. If you start reading through the Book of Shmuel and the Book of Malachim, you first encounter King David as a warrior, as a fighter. He fights Goliath. That's our first image of him. However, if you open the Talmud, the first image you get of King David is that King David gets up every night to do teshuva. He gets up every night to do tikkun chatzot. He's a scholar who's paskening halacha. He sits in the yeshiva and learns through his shulchan aruch and his gemara. I imagine that somebody who starts with the Talmud is going to have a very different impression in his mind of King David than the person who starts with the Tanakh.
Right.
And I think the appropriate order is to do it the way that it was written. First, the Tanakh was there, and the rabbinic reading is an overlay. It's a commentary. And one has to mediate between these two. I will say that in my book, there is a tremendous amount of rabbinic commentary, a huge number of Talmudic quotes, grappling with Midrash, medieval commentary like the Radak and whoever, the Ralbag and whoever it might be. But the first thing is to understand the text on its own, on basis.
Speaking to Rabbi Alex Israel, I would guess I know the answer to this question, but I would love for you to elaborate. King David, I would assume, only becomes more complicated as you study him. Would that be accurate?
I definitely think that's true.
And therefore, can one then come up with a composite opinion of King David, or as you explore more, it just becomes more confusing?
I don't think it becomes confusing. King David is a character where a tremendous amount is written by about him. I'm dealing with King Solomon,
right?
In the Book of Kings, because really it's only the first two chapters where we see King David in our book.
Right.
But if I would take Solomon as an example, I think many people have a very flat image of him. I think many people have a flat image of many biblical characters. People will say, "Oh, King Solomon, he was very rich, he was very wise." That's all they know about him.
Right.
And what I try and paint in the story is that there's actually a process going on. He's got a biography. He starts off as a young man, sort of very innocent and very well-intentioned. And he has a tremendous plan. His plan is to build the temple and to spread God's name. And he says, well, if I want to spread God's name far and wide, we can't be a backwater. We have to be an imperial center. Let's make ourselves powerful and strong, and let's control the region. He does that so successfully. But the funny thing is, eventually the imperial pursuits take over.
Right.
And instead of using the empire to further his religious goals, he finds that the empire takes on a, you know, Frankensteinian life of its own, and he doesn't know how to control it, and it starts controlling him. In this regard, I think that Solomon is a wonderful, wonderful metaphor of a person who's supremely talented, supremely well-intentioned, but isn't careful enough to keep things in check. And this can be relevant to us on a national level, where sometimes as a nation, we can lose sight of what our original goals are, and suddenly, whether it's in building our own country, in building our state, in developing our economy, we can lose sight of what the original intentions were. Or as individuals, sometimes we're looking for, you know, the classic metaphor, the guy who's hasn't got a lot of money and he's got a young family and he says, you know, I'm going to provide for you. I was always poor. I'm going to provide for you. And then I'm going to be able to spend lovely time with my family. Until he builds his business so much that he never sees his family. He never spends any time with them because the business takes over.
Life's all about a balance, huh?
it's about a balance, or maybe even more than a balance. It's about keeping your goals in mind, keeping your goals in check.
So King Solomon, we could say, was the proverbial big thinker, right? That's for sure. I mean, his plans were vast, and without his intentions, without his dreams, so to speak, the Jewish people would not have gotten to the point that they did get, right? That's a very big positive about King Solomon.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And by the same token, sometimes you wonder were there enough hours in the day for him to have accomplished and be involved in all the things he ended up being involved in. It seems like it seems that he's just so occupied with so much, so many relationships. I don't mean just personal. I'm talking about political and military and imperialistic, as you mentioned. So many different relationships, so many different, you know, balls in the air that needed to be juggled. By today's standards, today might seem like a joke compared to what he had to endure politically.
Well, look, he was formidable, like any emperor who had to manage a huge empire. And one imagines that he had to delegate quite a bit. One of the theories that I propose in the book, when we say, it's actually in the fifth chapter of Malachim, when it says that he spoke about all the plants and he spoke about all of the animals, in other words, that he was a master of science and a master of botany, the question is whether it was all him, because we see other instances in which he imports knowledge, he imports expertise, and this is something which I believe that he did quite a bit. He didn't do it all himself.
So he may have had a director of botany.
A director of what?
Botany. He may have had an expert in different areas that that he turned to.
I think he wanted Jerusalem to be the, you know, Yale and Harvard to be the Oxford and Cambridge of the entire civilized world. And he imported, you know, whatever know-how, whatever knowledge there was in order to achieve that aim. And then people would come not only to study, you know, material sciences or whatever it might be, but they would come to study philosophy. And there we have the book of Kohelet, the book of Mishlei, Proverbs, you know, Ecclesiastes with all their wisdom, and they'd come to find out about God. One of the most remarkable speeches of Solomon is when he opens the temple and would expect the temple to be just for Jews. He he opens the temple and he says, I'm expecting non-Jews to come here.
Right.
I'm going to be delighted when non-Jews come here. And please, God, listen to their prayers, because I've designed this whole thing so that the whole world will universally come to know you.
And just having finished the High Holidays, don't we know that, in fact, that's our ultimate goal, is to make sure that the nations of the world gather together in Jerusalem to praise God.
Right. So he was a big thinker, but I don't believe that he did it all himself. I think he had ways of turning his country into a center of industry, a center of trade, a center of international knowledge. And that's why you have people like the Queen of Sheba, who herself was a very wealthy, powerful lady, who says, comes to Jerusalem to visit him. And she says, it took my breath away. I couldn't believe what I saw there. Even what I was told, what I'd been briefed about, I'd only been told half of it. It must have been pretty impressive, Jerusalem in Solomon's time.
That's for sure. Is it unfair to simplify? We have this habit of referring to King David as the poet of Israel, and maybe King Solomon as the scholar of Israel. Aren't those titles vastly insufficient?
I'm going to agree with you. I think King David was far more than a poet. But I do think that King David had a tremendously religious heart. We know that not all the Psalms were written by King David.
Right.
But many of them are, and many of them are given biographical annotations. And we see that he seems to have had an ongoing dialogue with God. Now, again, we shouldn't imagine that at the same time he wasn't administrating his kingdom, wasn't a tremendous warrior. He certainly seems to have been pretty much, you know, he would have been the commander of one of the elite units in the Israelite army. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But at the same time, this was a person, and sometimes we see this even in contemporary reality, if I can come back to that. People like, you know, my children, my 15-year-old just finished reading the letters of Yoni Netanyahu. And there you see a guy who was the head of the elite commando force of the Israeli army, but was writing beautiful poetry and touching philosophical letters. And I think Lahavdil, I think David HaMelech is a truly religious personality, and Yoni Netanyahu wasn't. However, at the same time, here we have a warrior who is living with a constant dialogue to God, a dialogue about his triumphs, about his sins, about his despair, about his hopes,
right.
Personally, nationally, and it's exciting to get a vision of such a personality. I'll add that the Bible doesn't hide the sins of our great people. One of the proofs I always say that the Bible had to be written by prophets is that no king would have let this stuff be published. who would let David's sins and all of the dirt about his family? They would have like found some way of burying that information.
And the same in the case of King Solomon.
And it's the same in the case of King Solomon. King Solomon is definitely a scholar, but I would see him as a tremendous empire builder, tremendous trader. He took Israel as a country to heights we can never imagine. If we can think of, you know, some of the greatest statesmen in different countries who managed to take a country to a state of economic boom, who managed to make a country, you know, take it from, you know, being just another country to being the center of a regional center. That's what King Solomon did. So he was very impressive. But the Bible's less interested in that. It's interested in his spiritual orientation, because it is a prophetic book.
Rabbi Alex Israel is with us. We call this By the Book Tuesdays on the Nachum Segal Network. And today we get the opportunity to talk about Melachim Aleph, Kings number 1. Let me just remind our audience that if you find the stories in Tanakh confusing or complicated and want to know more about the biblical sites that are located in modern-day Israel, Magid Books has announced the Magid Studies in Tanakh. Magid Studies in Tanakh offers fascinating explorations of the Bible that bring you into the world of the prophets. You could ask your local Jewish bookstore or go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Magid Books is a division of Koren Publishers Jerusalem, and we are proud to have them as a wonderful sponsor of ours as we explore the world of Jewish books here at the Nachum Segal Network. I also remind you that the Simchas Torah special continues. That's right, Simchas Torah may be long gone, but Koren Publishers of Jerusalem encourages everybody to take advantage still of the 20% off as you could study Torah with the best scholars of today and save some money as well. Their Simchas Torah special is available to you. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com, for all the information. Rabbi Alex Israel is with us. He is the author of the Maggid Studies in Tanakh, Malachim Aleph, Torn in Two. We'll talk about that subtitle in a moment. He's a master educator whose teaching over the past two decades has inspired thousands of students in the U.S., Israel, and the U.K. to engage deeply with biblical texts. He teaches at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi, Director of Community Education at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, and also contributes regularly to Yeshivat HaRetzion's Israel Koshitsky Virtual Beit Midrash. Rabbi Israel, if you don't mind, a minute on the Virtual Beit Midrash. Explain to our listeners what that is.
The Virtual Beit Midrash is an unbelievable resource. It started about 20 years ago when the Internet was really, in a way, in its infancy. And Menachem Liptag, who was really the founder of it, realized that here we had a tremendous opportunity to spread Torah. Over the years, over the last 20 years, it probably puts out the most serious text-based articles on whether it's Talmud, whether it is Bible, whether it is Jewish philosophy, Jewish thinkers, and what have you. Frequently the articles are long. It's not your sort of like snapshot, you know, that you can sit and read in 20 seconds as you're browsing through. But if you're looking for a really serious study course on books of Tanakh, on the Parashat HaShavua, or even if you're trying to prepare a Talmud shiur, it's a phenomenal resource. I know so many teachers around the world who it's almost the first place they log in to find their resource material. So it's great. It's really good stuff.
It has a sterling reputation, continued success with that. Is it safe to say, back to our publication, is it safe to say that the first 10 chapters of Malachim is the most glorious time as a nation in Jewish history?
It's difficult for me to grade it, but it certainly seems like the first 10 chapters is a time when we have the largest borders, the kingdom is united, and it basically, from chapter 12 of the book, the kingdom is split apart. There's a revolution, and what was the sort of cohesive nation, or what seemed that way, I think there were significant cracks beneath the surface, suddenly gets ripped apart. And we split into two kingdoms. So it was a glorious time of unity.
And the Jewish people would pine for those times centuries later? Would it be a period of time that Jews would look back and long for?
I think so. Let's try and put even the Book of Kings in perspective. The Book of Kings traditionally is written by Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived after the destruction of the temple. By the way, this is the sort of dating that the academics agree with. The academic community agrees that the Book of Kings was written shortly after the destruction of the temple and the exile from the land. I'm talking about the first temple.
Right.
Now, that means that the author of the Book of Kings is looking back on something like 300 years of history, and he decides to write a book from the building of the temple to its destruction. And he wants to survey the period. You know, I remember after 9/11, I think there was an academic called Bernard Lewis, and he wrote a book, What Went Wrong? What Went Wrong? If I had to give a working title to the Book of Kings, that's the title. What Went Wrong? What did we do wrong? How did we get into this mess? Why are we in exile? Why is our temple destroyed? And the Book of Kings charts every king and says, what did you contribute to the downfall of the kingdom, or how did you put the brakes on? And that's really what it's doing. I mean, with some kings it spends more time, or with some it's more telegraphic. But that's really what it's trying to chart out. And the Book of Kings has a thesis about what went wrong. It thinks that the main culprit is idolatry, cultural pollution, let's call it. And that's the sin it pins on the people, and on their leaders more than the people. So it's a very, very organized book with a thesis, and I would say definitely that it looks back to the time of Solomon as a sort of heyday and says, wait, it was sort of downhill from there.
I apologize breaking things down to one of my favorite things, which is statistics, but if you'll allow me for a moment, what percentage of the kings in Malachim then encouraged a Jewish revival and an enhanced Jewish spirit, and what percentage, unfortunately, were in power as the Jewish people continued their spiraling downfall?
If you wanted me to, I'd have to do the statistics, but if you want me to give a rough benchmark,
sure,
I'd go for something like 25% on the good side.
Right. Oh, actually, that seems pretty high for somebody who has not spent as much time as you with the holy books of the Tanakh. I thought that was pretty high. I'm actually glad to hear that it's 25%, frankly. I hope that that's as accurate as you think it is, because I always think that it's few and far between. But maybe 25%, in fact, reflects just that. By the way, many historians have spoken about this period as Jeremiah explains it and describes it. And of course, talk about the glory that the Jewish people were enveloped in during that period of time. And, of course, the terrible downfall. And many historians are fascinated by how a people was able to survive a downfall like that. Would that be an appropriate way of looking at it, that any other people, so to speak, would never have been able to persevere and actually make it till this day after that type of spiraling or out of control existence that was going on after the temple was destroyed?
I certainly do think that we look at the survival of Jews as a miracle of history. You know, there's no equivalent in the history of the world with people who have managed to, to keep going. Now, I think part of that is the fact that we adapt and we do evolve, and we've managed, for example, to survive without a land, without a temple, and I see it around me, Judaism changing as we do return to our country and to living here in so many different ways. So we've, thank God, got a very malleable tool. The Torah seems to be able not to remain static, but to allow us to adapt and change to our environment, and that's helped us keep going, I think.
Rabbi Alex Israel is with us. All right, the subtitle, because it's so... It's so interesting. Torn in two. I mean, to anybody who did study Tanakh in elementary school, we remember, of course, that the kingdom was split. But the torn in two that you referred to goes so far beyond just the kingdom being torn in two. How many other themes in Malachim have the are able to have the subtitle of torn in two?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the most the moment, if I could even point to one verse,
sure,
which I would imagine when I thought about torn in two, it was that moment where the great prophet Elijah stands on Mount Carmel, and the people there are having a very hard time with their religious orientation. On the one hand, they seem to be worshipping God, and they're worshipping the Baal. And he turns around to them and says, you've got to make a choice. Why are you hovering or hopping between two opinions? The people are torn in two. They don't know whether to worship God or the Baal. And let me just say that it was a very difficult choice. You see, Baal, for example, was the rain god. Baal is the god of the rain. Archaeologists verify this. And if you're a farmer in ancient Israel, you need rain. Even today, Israel's short of rain. And let's say God's not providing it, so the Shema tells us that we should keep the mitzvot, but let's say that's not doing its stuff. You say, well, won't harm if I go to the local Baal temple and offer a sacrifice or a prayer. I mean, God's not going to mind too much. Or even if he is, maybe it'll help my crops. And this was the culture surrounding them. Now, they weren't only torn between the Baal and God. They were torn between cultures. Elijah is talking to a people who are really attracted to Phoenician culture. Phoenicia is the most cosmopolitan, modern, incredible economy. So what we're dealing with here is people who are caught between the proverbial Israel and America.
So this is not a 2013 problem. this has been with us for a long time. In terms of people deciding.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Hello.
Oh, I apologize. We'll wait for Rabbi Alex Israel to reconnect with us in just a moment and continue here. This is By the Book, here at the Nachum Segal Network, and I believe we have Rabbi Israel with us again. Rabbi Israel, are you there? Rabbi Israel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here now.
I apologize for that. Your point was made. You may not have realized that we heard it. in terms of the, and I was commenting how this problem that we think is only in 2013 is something that we see in the early parts of Jewish history, where literally people are choosing between, I guess we would call it, the spiritual and the mundane, right?
Spiritual and the mundane, between universal values to be part of the world community or to be part of a more, you know, smaller identity, parochial community. So this is one of the things, where areas in which we're torn. Solomon is torn between his wealth,
right,
and between God. You have a character like Jeroboam, which maybe we'll talk about later, Jeroboam, who's got a divine mandate to split the kingdom. But then he says, wait, if I secede, if I create my own country, but the Jews are still going to want to go back to Jerusalem to worship in the temple, how am I going to resolve that? So he finds himself in a real bind between, do I create two kingdoms, or how am I going to resolve that religiously? So all these different characters, Ahab is like caught between his wife, Jezebel, and the prophet Elijah. Every character there is torn in two, and it's fascinating to watch these people struggle with these different polar attractions that they have, and to see how they grapple with them.
Why was Jeroboam relegated historically to being the prime example of somebody whose negative influence can have such an impact on the Jewish people? There are a lot of people in our history that we could point to for that, aren't there? But it seems that he's the prime example.
Well, they talk about the three kings who have no place in the world to come: Jeroboam, Ahab, and Manasseh. And these are the three kings who really furthered idolatry more than any other. These people were committed to idolatry. They took idolatry to a totally new level. And Jeroboam split the kingdom and created new shrines in Bethel and Dan. So since Jeroboam sort of like turned his back on the temple in Jerusalem and created alternative centers, I think he gets that very low reputation.
So even with the split being required, so to speak, still Jerusalem was supposed to remain the epicenter. Even with the inevitability of the split. Hello? All right, we're having trouble hearing Rabbi Israel. And we will try to... Rabbi, you there? We'll try to reconnect with Rabbi Israel coming up here at the Nachum Segal Network, and continue our conversation as we explore the book of Malachim Aleph, Torn in Two, a presentation of Koren Publishers. korenpub.com is the email, is the web address. We encourage everybody to take advantage of the Simchas Torah specials, where you could study Torah with the best scholars of today and still save by going to the Koren website. This specific work, Rabbi Alex Israel's Torn in Two, Malachim Aleph, is part of the Magid Studies and Tanakh series, and that is, of course, on the from Koren Publishers. Rabbi Israel, are you there? I don't know why we're having so much difficulty with our phone lines. I have a feeling it might be from the Israel connection, but we will try to continue to get our conversation on the air. Meanwhile, I remind everybody that if you find stories in Tanakh confusing or complicated, if you want to know where the biblical sites are located in modern-day Israel, Magid Books has announced the Magid Studies in Tanakh series. Magid Studies in Tanakh offers fascinating explorations of the Bible that bring you into the world of the prophets. Ask your local Jewish bookstore. Go to korenpub.com. Magid Books, a division of Koren Publishers Jerusalem, and they bring you this segment entitled By the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. And those of you who want to take advantage of their Simchas Torah special sale, we recommend you go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Rabbi Israel, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
I have a feeling it's on the Israel end, but I might be wrong. If it's on our end, I sincerely apologize. I was just mentioning that the split among the kingdoms was required, so to speak. But as your last point was regarding Jeroboam, that the epicenter had to remain Jerusalem, and that was the problem that he faced, correct?
That is correct. I've got to say that sometimes, and even when I was writing the book, I hope it won't be wrong to say, even though I wrote a book about the Book of Kings, there are still certain looming questions. And that is really one of the questions I found difficult to solve. God commands Yeravam to split the kingdom. And he says, you're going to take, you know, 10 tribes and leave Judah with two. And Jeroboam says, well, I don't get it. You know, if the people, every time they want to celebrate, you know, Pesach or Sukkot, they're going to go back to Jerusalem. And, of course, who presides there? Well, the king of Judah. So that's going to bring me down. And how was he meant to resolve that? I mean, he comes up with a solution of his own. He creates his own shrines, and he creates a sort of a new type of religious cult. But what was he meant to do? Was he meant to turn to the prophet and say, what do I do? What would have been the correct recourse? And it's one of the questions the book doesn't answer. Were we meant to have possibly the American model, sort of United States of Israel, two states which would have been united in some way but would have retained their independence and had some sort of union or alliance? Possibly that's the solution, but we don't really know.
Wow. You'd think that in a situation like his, an alternative would have been provided.
it's quite remarkable. However, you know, this was an old festering split. It goes back to the split between Joseph and his brothers, which right. goes back to the split between Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah had this tension. Rachel's major famous son is Joseph. And Leah, well, you know, Reuben sins and Shimon and Levi sin, and then we've got Judah, who's the most prominent son. And it seems like these energies in the Jewish people fester throughout centuries. And it's at this point that this sort of, you know, we have it even in our Jewish world today. There seem to be certain divisions which don't go away so easily. And there are really interesting questions about Jewish unity in this book, and our ability, you know, maybe to ensure that the internal ethnic divisions or the internal tribal divisions between us don't rip us apart.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable. And the thread of Jewish history, it's so vital. And now, of course, we're just starting Bereishis, Noach, and the parshios that are going to lead up to the episodes that you're referring to. And it's so important to remember just how far back it goes and exactly when it began. This was not something that was a product of the era of the Nevi'im. This is a product that's that is from the era of our forefathers and foremothers, which is sometimes difficult to remember. I must ask you, especially from a layperson like myself, for whom Eliyahu Hanavi is most closely associated with, I don't know, Motzei Shabbat and the Havdalah service, or with
the Seder,
or of course a Brit Milah. You know, I mean, so to tell us who Eliyahu Hanavi really was, as opposed to some of the different parts of his reputation that have become popular in popular Jewish culture.
Okay, well, that's a great question. I have to say that Eliyahu has two personalities. He has one personality in the Book of Kings, in Sefer Melachim, and he seems to become much more warm and friendly afterwards, maybe on the basis of the Book of Malachi, and I'll try and explain. In the Book of Kings, Eliyahu is this ardent fighter for God and for the purity of monotheism, and he's going to fight King Ahab and Jezebel. I mean, they are running a pretty mean regime. They're slaughtering the prophets of God and Baal, the official religion. And Eliyahu won't have it. And he gets up in the name of God and says, there's not going to be any rain until you turn around. Now, he withholds the rain not just for one season, but for three entire years. And you can only imagine what disaster that wreaks over the nation. And he tries to bring the nation to this point with this sort of showdown on the Mount Carmel, where the people will reach this clarity of vision where they say, Hashem hu ha-Elohim, Hashem hu ha-Elohim. They're all proclaiming God exclusively. His aim is really to bring that clarity to the nation, and he brings fire down from heaven. Elijah is the prophet of fire. Everything with him is fiery. He brings fire down from heaven not once, not twice, many times, and he goes up in fire to heaven. But he doesn't know how to compromise. the day after that incredible spectacle on Mount Carmel, the very next day, Jezebel issues a death warrant for him. Now, he's been planning this show for 3 years. 3 years of famine, so he could get everybody to accept God. And now the government has a death warrant out for him, and he doesn't know what to do. And he goes into the desert, and he just seems to have a breakdown. He collapses. And it seems from the story, certainly the way I read the story, that God says to him, you're okay, Elijah, you know, God's not in the fire. God's not in the earthquake. He's in the small voice. Take it slow. You can change people slowly. And you know what Elijah does at that point? You know what he says to God? He says, listen, God, I'm a zealot. I'm a zealot. I only know one way. It's the way of the fire. It's the way of the earthquake. I don't know small voices. I can't do things slowly. I can't do things in half measures. It's either everything or nothing. And what God says to him at that point is, okay, you know what? You can stand down. I'm going to appoint Elisha as the prophet instead of you. Mm. That's Elijah in the Book of Kings. In later on, in the Book of Malachi, we have a completely different Elijah. Elijah is the person who's going to herald the Messiah. Elijah is going to be the person who is going to come along and tell people that he's going to restore fathers to children, children to fathers, a completely different type of Eliyahu, who's friendly, who's going to be a man of redemption, a man to assist us, but not this zealot.
A totally different type of person, or just somebody who a different side of his personality ends up, you know, sort of, I hate to use the word, but in Jewish folklore, if you will, or, you know, in a more spiritual sense.
Well, Elijah goes up in a flaming chariot to heaven. Did he die? When it says he's going to come back, what exactly does that mean? He seems to come back with and certainly the persona that we have is a very different one. Now, there is a fabulous midrash about why he visits every Brit Milah. Because one of the things that Elijah says is, he says to God, you know, the people, they're always sinning. They break your covenant. And the midrash from Kirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says, they break my covenant? They don't keep the Brit? Hey, Eliyahu, I'm going to send you to every Brit. You can't say that the Jewish people don't keep the Brit. And therefore, from then on, he has to go to every Brit Milah. And we set aside an Elijah chair at every Brit Milah,
right,
because he sort of maligned the Jewish people. And God forces him to attend every Brit Milah ever since. According to this, God is trying to tame Elijah's zealousness, his purity of vision, and says, hey, you know, I created a world, but it's shades of gray. It's not all black and white, you know, like you want it to be, Elijah. And it's really remarkable. But in the book of Kings, Elijah is a very, very zealous, a very black and white character, a very fiery character, a real extremist.
Do scholars like yourselves ponder why someone like Elijah is the one who will herald the Messiah? When there may be other worthier, or maybe, you know, other types of personalities in our tradition who might be, I don't want to say more deserving, maybe more fitting for the role, or that's just the sports guy in me who likes to make those type of athletic comparisons. And in reality, you as a scholar are fine with the tradition dictating that it be Elijah who heralds his coming.
Well, Elijah, you know, this is based in various sources. The classic source text is what we read on Shabbat HaGadol, just before Pesach. Hine anochi sholach lechem et Eliyahu hanavi lifnei bo yom Hashem HaGadol v'hanorach. God says, I will send Elijah the prophet before that great and fearful day, and he will restore, you know, the hearts of fathers to sons. And there's a big debate about what that means. One possibility could be that it's still the sort of fiery Elijah, and that he's coming before the judgment day, right, to get us ready to drive fear into our hearts, and in which case Elijah hasn't changed that much. But the truth is that there are, you know, and some people will say that that's exactly what the time of the Messiah is. It's a time of clarity. And since Elijah is about clarity, that's why he's so associated with that. But, you know, it's fascinating to compare different characters. So you have Elijah, who's always a loner. He's always by himself. He's a very stark and very, as I say, black and white binary character. And then you've got his pupil or his student, his protege, Elisha. And Elisha's very social and very gentle. He's always with other people. He's always doing miracles, which are not miracles to demonstrate God's strength, but not miracles to burn people up, but miracles to assist people. So even in the world of the prophets, there are many, many different personalities. But Elijah does seem to stand, you know, very much head and shoulders above many of the other prophets.
All right. Rabbi Alex Israel is with us. He is author of the brand new book entitled Melachim Aleph, Kings 1, Torn in Two. It's part of the Magid Studies in Tanakh. It's a Magid release. You can go to Koren Publishers, KORENPUB.com for more information. And we encourage everybody to support Koren Publishers. They are releasing works like these that are just having an amazing influence on so many different generations. And speaking of generations, and we are at the beginning of the Torah now, at the brand new Torah cycle, Rabbi Israel. We alluded earlier to your exploration to find certain midrashim, to desperately discover where some of the stories that we are taught as youngsters are actually found. And, of course, to your dismay, you did not find them in the text, right? That was one of the things you brought up earlier.
Right.
So what is your recommendation? Do we need a complete revamping of our educational system in terms of what we do or don't teach the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds? Would you like to see something like that? Or could small adjustments accomplish the same thing?
Yeah, I think it's going to be small adjustments. It's a really interesting question. My mother was a elementary school principal, and she was very careful to just teach the Pshat and only later to teach the Drush. And when I, you know, some of my students, when they do discover that some of the Midrashim they thought were in the text are not in there, they get very angry about it. They would like this purist education. On the other hand, we all know that some of these Midrashic images are so powerful, they're so evocative. The rabbis were master storytellers. And I certainly find that I'm frequently studying just the pure text, and suddenly a midrash I learned as a 7-year-old will pop into my mind, and suddenly I'll understand it in a more metaphorical way. And it opens things up. So I don't think I would jettison studying Rashi, which is full of midrash. And I think, you know, maybe what we really need to do is actually educate our teachers better, to help our teachers to understand more about the difference between pshat and drash. And our teachers should be more aware of what is in the text and what isn't. And then they can, as students grow in their sophistication, they can play to that ability to achieve that nuance.
Right. They're the ones to make the minor adjustments. And then for the kids, it'll be a major difference, I guess we could put it that way.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Rabbi Israel, are you responsible for other publications? Is your first, your 10th? Where are you in terms of the publishing world?
This is my first book. I chose to write about the Book of Kings because really so many students, they love reading the stories of Joshua, the Book of the Judges. They love reading the books of Shmuel, and they get to Malachim, and it's all lists, and it's all these dates and names, and they get stuck. And I said, okay, I'm going to help my students with this one. But I do have two other books in the pipeline. Hopefully next year I'm going to bring out a book on the Chagim, on the Jewish festivals. And the following year I should be bringing out 2 Kings. So plenty of writing still going on.
How does Malachim Bet compare to Malachim Aleph?
Oh, it's even more depressing.
At least the Malachim.
I mean, the temple's destroyed.
At least
the tribes go to exile.
At least the Malachim. At least the Malachim Aleph, we have a good run, huh?
The problem is, this is sometimes when I look, you know, you're looking for the happy end. It ain't there.
Like you said, if it was a novelist who was writing, it would probably have a different ending, huh? And we must remember the perseverance of the Jewish people, because again, as I said to you earlier, and I've been told this since I was a kid by many scholars, if you look at that first temple era and the destruction of the temple, the fact that the Jewish people were able to persevere and survive is simply remarkable, a true testament. Look, we saw it on our own, and not that we saw it on our own, but of course, previous generations saw it on their own in the 20th century. How the Jewish people are resilient, and I guess that through all the destruction, that's a very important positive message to keep in mind.
For sure, and I think that when you look at all the prophets, you look at you look at Yeshayahu, you look at Yirmiyahu, you look at Yechezkel, who saw really bitter times. they all end off their books with notes of hope, with notes of comfort. It's going to get better. It's going to be okay.
Right.
So that hope is sort of very much, you know, hotwired into our system.
Rabbi Israel, to say this hour has been a delight would be an understatement. Thank you so much for joining us. It was just...
Thank you very much to you and to all your listeners.
And mazal tov on the book. It's your first, and I'm sure first of many. Thank you and shana tova to you.
Thank you very much, shana tova, and I hope everybody enjoys reading it.
Rabbi Alex Israel is, I'm sure everybody will enjoy reading it. He is the author of Malachim Aleph Torn Into, a Magid release. Go to Koren Publishers. KORENPUB.com for information. Take advantage of the Simchas Torah special, 20% off, where you could study Torah with the best scholars of today. Koren has some incredible works, and this is among them. And our friends from Koren remind you that if you are finding these stories in Tanakh confusing or complicated, or if you want to know where the biblical sites are located in modern-day Israel, Magid Books has announced the Magid Studies in Tanakh, or by Israel's work is part of it. They offer fascinating explorations of the Bible that bring you into the world of the prophets. You can ask your local Jewish bookseller or go to KorenPub.com. Magid Books is a division of Koren Publishers, Jerusalem. And they are doing an absolutely remarkable job. Tell all your friends, everybody you know, that we are doing a fresh program each week on the Nachum Segal Network every Tuesday morning. And we invite you to tune in and to enjoy these conversations. And, of course, you could check out our Nachum Segal Network app and download the program at any point you want to listen to it and to send it out to your friends and relatives and anybody you have on your email list who you think might be intrigued by these conversations. I thank Koren Publishers for giving us the opportunity to do this because it is just, it's remarkable for me to spend an entire hour with phenomenal authors. And I thank Rabbi Israel for joining us here at the Nachum Segal Network. I also remind everybody that we are now in season number 2 of the Nachum Segal Network, which means a whole bunch of great brand new programs are being introduced as we go through the week. And I invite everybody to take advantage and to download the programs, tune in from wherever you are, whether it be through our listen line on the telephone, whether it be on our apps, whether it be on your computer, on your smartphone browser, on your laptop, your iPad, whatever the case may be. Tune in, enjoy. We have so much of our programming that is dominated by Jewish music, and of course we sprinkle in some fantastic talk and enlightening conversation like we just did during this hour, courtesy of Koren Publishers. Go to korenpub.com for all the information that you need about today's author, about today's book, and about the different things that Koren has available. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, on Tuesday, we will use the opportunity of the segment that we like to call By the Book to highlight another author here at the Nachum Segal Network. And we hope that you'll be tuned in and will join us for that program. Make sure to follow us on Facebook, Jewish Radio World with Nachum Segal, where we continuously update you on what's going on. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at Nachum Segal Net so that you can be up to date on everything that is happening. My thanks to Koren Publishers and my thanks to all of you for tuning in and being part of By the Book right here at the Nachum Segal Network. Catch you next time. Thank you.